Oh my God, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh please. Are you ready for this?
Cameraman,
that
what the hell is that? Midway across the Hudson River with a perfectly circular disc.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that it is like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead, doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Hello. It's been a difficult time for me since the last program, and I'm sure many of you have been wondering what happened. So let me give you some background. Just after Christmas 2007, my partner Bobby Rowley, who was involved in this program in many ways, was diagnosed with cancer. Her condition deteriorated, as did my ability to continue producing this program. And sadly, after many ugly treatments, Bobby succumbed to the cancer in June of this year, right around the time that it became increasingly apparent that my old mom, who is 89, needed someone to be with her on a 24/7 basis. So a few weeks after Bobby's funeral, I moved the VSN headquarters to my mother's. Now, gradually over the past couple of months, the urge to get back in your ears has become stronger. So this is edition 469 of these Strange Days Indeed, where we'll celebrate the lives of the late Richard Hall and Mac Tonnies. We'll talk with David Cherniak about his long-awaited UFOs, the Secret History box set. And Alfred Lemberg will take us home. But first up, though, as usual, with his take, this time on Dick Hall, is Dave Furlong.
These are Strange Days Indeed on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it is Dave Furlong.
Richard Hall has left us a legacy. A legacy of meticulous, level-headed, and intense investigation into UFOs and everything that accompanies them. He has carefully documented reports about UFOs and extraterrestrial creatures since the 1950s. And maintained an interest into the phenomena right up until he left this mortal plane. But the legacy that he has left behind has a price, and that price is to continue his work. Continue the work in a manner that is factual, exact, and is so thoroughly investigated that the only way to discredit the work is if someone ignores the facts of the case. Richard Hall's work is unfinished, and he has thrown the gauntlet down to ufologists to carry on this work. On his website, hallrichard.com, there exists a body of work that begs to be completed before it is too late. Approximately two-thirds of the way down Richard's website, there is a link entitled Running Code, The Night the Alien Died. And it is about an unfinished book that Richard did not get the chance to finish the research on. What really intrigues me about this link is that Richard has done all the work in the form of writing the prologue for the case. A case that sounds like something straight out of the Twilight Zone, involving lights in the sky, spacecraft, extraterrestrials, military personnel, police, both military and civilian, and enough eyewitnesses to fill a courtroom. The event took place in January of 1978 at McGuire Air Force Base in New Jersey. an air base that's attached to the Army base of Fort Dix for the purposes of doing military airlifts. Now, Richard vetted the main witnesses, Sergeants Jeff Morse and Mark Larimer, air police that were stationed at McGuire. Richard just needed an advance on the book to get down there and do some in-depth investigation, but unfortunately, it never happened. Running code refers to police vehicles running code 3, or running with their lights and sirens going. And on the night in question, January the 18th, 1978, there was a lot of that going on with both military and civilian police vehicles. What amazes me about this particular case is not only the abundance of witnesses that can verify the event, but additionally, the level of detail that was given. It begins with the air police being alerted to watch out for anything strange because there are a multitude of bluish-green lights that are conducting aerobatic maneuvers above the airbase. Jeff Morse counted at least a dozen of the objects that were moving in formation, changing formation, and also breaking formation. And the air show went on for more than 2 hours before the air police noticed that the New Jersey State Police were on their way to the Fort Dix gate with their sirens and lights going. Morse and Larimer were dispatched to meet with the New Jersey State Police to assist them. While they were on their way, they overheard that one of the Army MPs was in hot pursuit of one of the lights that was flying low over the area and had lost contact with his dispatcher. When he regained contact with his dispatcher, he gave an amazing report. The oval object had stopped and was hovering over his vehicle, and that was when his radio stopped working. As he was looking at this object, he saw a being appear in front of him, and he panicked. He said the creature was approximately 4 feet tall, grayish-brown in color, with a large head, long arms, and a slender body. The MP pulled his sidearm and pumped 5 rounds into the creature and fired 1 round into the sky at the object hovering over his vehicle. The MP also said that the object shot straight up into the sky, and the wounded creature had managed to flee and headed toward the fence line that separated Fort Dix from McGuire Air Force Base. Morse and Larimer were instructed to look for the creature on the Air Force side, while Army personnel were looking for the creature on the Fort Dix side. The New Jersey State Trooper joined them in the search, and the two vehicles eventually braked to a halt when they discovered a body lying on cold concrete of an inactive runway. At first, they thought it might have been one of the homeless people that lived near the bases. But when they got closer to it, they found that it matched the description given by the MP. About 4 feet tall, grayish-green, big head, long arms, and it appeared to be dead. In addition to that, there was a strong odor of ammonia in the air. And the air police and the state police officer struggled, trying to come to grips with what they were looking at. The issue was now a military matter, because a dead body was found on the airbase, and Morse and Larimer were told to escort the New Jersey State Police off the base and seal off the area where the dead body was located. Once they had done that, they secured the area with tape and rope, and were instructed to set up checkpoints and allow only authorized personnel to enter the area. A special van and a unit simply referred to as a recovery unit were dispatched to the area, and they crated the body, placed it on a plane, and flew it back to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, according to Morse and Larimer, they were shipped off to different bases not too long after that. But before they left, they were debriefed, and they were warned not to say anything about the entire event to anyone. Now, I'm not sure when Richard began working on this report, or when he wrote the epilogue, or the prologue that was outlining all of these events, but there is still time for someone to do a thorough investigation of this and get some hard factual eyewitness accounts, because it has only been 31 years since this event took place. We have received an inheritance from Richard Hall in the form of his unpublished book, Running Code, The Night the Alien Died, and it is an inheritance that is of incalculable value to all ufologists. But that's just my take on it.
Good take, Dave, and really, really too bad that Richard Hall is no longer with us.
Yes.
There have been a lot of people who haven't made it to find out what the answer is to this thing that we are so deeply immersed in.
Now he counts himself amongst that group.
However, there's a distinct possibility that he's found out about what it all is.
That he's sitting there having a drink and putting his feet up and going, ha-ha, I know.
He and Hynek and Jim and Carl Lorenzen and all gathered together in that heavenly group of researchers in the sky. And maybe they're scratching their heads wondering why they bothered their asses with it.
Get over to the other side, find out what's been going on and go, oh, really?
But a fascinating case that he was looking into, and I guess had Enron not gone down along with his pension, he would have probably been able to follow up and go and do some in-the-field research.
Exactly, because that's what this thing is begging for, to get some people down there and basically start talking to some of these people face-to-face who said they were there, actually at this thing. Because a lot of calls went in about what was going on in the sky.
I'm wondering if there are any current real researchers who will hear this and follow up on it, or who've been to Richard Hall's site, hallrichard.com, while it's still there, and have been intrigued enough to perhaps decide to follow up.
I hope so.
I do too.
One of the things right off the bat, of course, would be finding that particular MP. He was only a young kid at the time, the same as these two air police. So you're talking people that are like in their 50s now, maybe.
The smell of ammonia from the corpse on the runway, on the disused runway.
I did a little bit of research myself as well and found that that's not unusual. That's been reported before, the smell of ammonia in contact with some of these creatures.
I don't think I've come across any references to the smell of ammonia in connection with UFO sightings, reports, close encounters. However, there are many researchers who have reported witnesses saying that there was a smell of sulfur.
Yeah, I've seen some of that as well, but might be wishful thinking. I'm almost positive that somewhere within the Roswell context, there was a smell of ammonia, which would make sense. Dead.
Any other cases that you recall where there was a mention of ammonia?
The only ones that I know of off the top of my head that involve potential dead aliens are basically Roswell and this one. We've had close encounters in terms of aliens actually being sighted, but nothing that involved dead ones that I can recall. But in either case, yes, there's definitely smells associated with UFOs.
Yeah, the smell of ozone.
That's always a big one, and which makes a lot of sense in terms of the disturbance of the atmosphere.
Bumper cars in the sky.
Yeah.
I love the smell of ozone around the bumper car. On the midway.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to miss Richard Hall. He was very forthright about his objections to the idiocy that went on around so-called research in the UFO field and the way that people jumped to conclusions and wanted to leapfrog the scientific method.
Yeah, he was very matter-of-fact in terms of, okay, where's your evidence to support what you're claiming?
And there were many people who incurred his ire.
Oh, yes.
Especially on the updates list. I'm really going to miss Richard Hall. He's one of the original deep thinkers as far as this field is concerned, and there aren't too many of his type left.
No, they're not at all. And he was doing it for a very, very, very long time, and he didn't give up. He didn't say, okay, I've had enough, I'm quitting. He went at it and went at it because, like all of us, all he wants is the same thing we all want. We want to know what it is.
And what I'm particularly pleased about is that he was really very careful to make sure that his archives went to people who could use them and look after them. People like Rod Dyke out in Seattle, Washington, who got the bulk of his archives, along with Wendy Connors. And Rod, for those of you who don't know, has a coach house on his property, and apparently that is stuffed with UFO archives, filing cabinet after filing cabinet after filing cabinet. And John Velez is the recipient of Richard's research into abductions.
Oh, excellent.
And apparently John is going to be putting up a lot of that stuff at virtuallystrange.net. Right on the front page there is the Abduction Information Center link. So the listener might want to go and check that out periodically and see if
what's coming up.
And undoubtedly, a lot of listeners also read the updates archive. And again, undoubtedly, John will post updates to the list about what he's put up at the Abduction Information Center portion of virtuallystrange.net.
There'll be a lot of stuff still to come, and it's all part and parcel of what Richard has left to all of us.
I could get real maudlin and sad all over again over Richard's passing, but I'm sure he would like us to get on with it and not fret too hard about his having gone.
He'd probably be saying, guys, relax. I'm up here, I'm having a good time. You have fun.
In my doesn't hurt body, which will be just wonderful for him.
Yes, exactly.
Thank you, Furry.
Thank you.
We'll talk again soon.
For sure.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Open the door, Richard. Open the door and let me in. Open the door, Richard. Richard, why don't you open the door?
Open the door, Richard.
Richard Hall passed away on July 17th, 2009. And here's the first time that he joined us on the broadcast version of Strange Days Indeed 10 years ago, in September 1999, when my co-host was John Karras.
Standing here groping in my coat pocket and I just can't find the key. Open the door, Richard. Open the door and let me in.
Our guest tonight is a legend in the serious study of UFO phenomena, a very well-respected researcher amongst his peers. In fact, whenever a 10 most credible ufologist list is published, Richard Hall's name is prominent on that list.
Richard Hall is a former assistant director and acting director of the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, NICAP, and in that capacity was editor of the 200,000-word documentary report The UFO Evidence, and a consultant to the University of Colorado UFO Project, sponsored by the U.S. Air Force Office of Scientific Research. He's a former editor of the MUFON Journal and past chairman of UFO Research Coalition, UFORC.
Richard's UFO-related publication credits include a 1968 Encyclopedia Britannica Book of the Year article, the introduction and epilogue in the 1968 Prentice Hall book, Mysteries of the Skies, UFOs in Perspective. He edited the book, UFO Evidence, and several other articles and a major appendix with a byline in the 1980 Doubleday Encyclopedia of UFOs.
Richard has a huge list of UFO-related credits, and we barely scratched the surface here in our introduction to him.
Joining us from his home in Brentwood, Maryland, is our guest tonight on Strange Days Indeed, Richard Hall.
Good evening, Richard.
Good evening.
Welcome to Strange Days Indeed, although you've lived in them for a very long time, goodness knows.
Strange years, let's call it.
Richard, off the top, we always like to ask our guests how it was that they first became involved in ufology.
Well, in my case, I was an enlisted man in the U.S. Air Force, and at that time, I used to see things posted up on the bulletin board, just standard wire service news copy. And at that time, which was 1949, 1950, Major Kehoe's first book came out, Flying Saucers Are Real, and I checked that out of the base Air Force Base Library, actually, and read it and so forth. So I got very involved there, and that first piqued my interest. My first serious involvement came later on after I got out of the Air Force and went back to college in 1954 at Tulane University, and there's where, while I was working on a scholarship in the math department, a letter came in one day that changed my life, literally. That came from Washington, D.C., signed by Major John Lee Kehoe on behalf of NICAP, addressed to the resident astronomer at Tulane, who was also a math professor. And part of my scholarship, I opened the mail and distributed it around to the faculty, so the letter came to me.
So the book that first turned you on to the subject, the author of that book sent a letter. Which must have excited you at the time, I
Indeed
guess.
Indeed it did,
yeah.
And I got in touch with him. I passed on the letter, but I privately jotted down the address, and I contacted him, and the rest is history, so to speak. I did, in fact, contact him, and immediately when I graduated Tulane, I moved to Washington, D.C., and I did not go immediately to work for NICAP, but I did very soon thereafter, spent 10 years there.
How well-formed was NICAP at the time that you became involved with it? Of course, NICAP being the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena. Where did it come from?
It was formed in 1956. By a group of Washington, D.C. area professional people, doctors, lawyers, you know, scientists, who thought that the subject deserved a lot more serious attention than it was getting. And they got off to a kind of a false start, and then they brought in Major Kehoe, who had already written a book on the subject. By that time, he had written two books on the subject. And when he took over, things started to move, and that's when I got involved. But that's the origins of NICAP. It was a group of pretty high-level people, and the original board of directors of NICAP included senior military officers, generals, admirals, so forth, you know, scientists, university-affiliated people. So it was a very respectable group of people.
It certainly was.
Richard, I understand that back in 1965, when you were still quite active with NICAP at that point, I believe, there was a security clearance done by the CIA on you, and you didn't know about that. How did that come about, and what was it about anyway?
That is correct. I did report that in my book, Uninvited Guests, which was published in 1988 and is still in print.
And I have a copy of it in my hand as we speak. Nice cover.
Okay. You may be interested to know that it has been at least in five foreign languages, and last I knew is still in print in German and Hebrew. So if you have listeners in Israel or Germany, they should go out there and buy it.
Yeah, because this should be on the bookshelves of most people who are seriously interested in UFO phenomena. That's Uninvited Guests, Richard Hall's book.
Now, to answer your question,
About the CIA.
I was at NICAP, and I got a call one day in January of 1965 from the Central Intelligence Agency, and a gentleman who identified himself, name as I recall, was William Coleman. I believe that's it. It's in the book, I'm pretty sure. But he wanted to make an appointment and come talk to me, and I said, sure. And he came into the office, And I said, do you want to talk privately or openly? Let's go behind closed doors. So we went behind closed doors. And I, not being naive, I asked him to show me his credentials, which he did. And he had a legitimate CIA ID. And he proceeded to ask me how we at NICAP investigated cases and so forth and so on. And I gave him a thorough briefing on it. This was far before the days when the CIA had the negative connotation that it now tends to have, at least in some quarters. You know, it was just an advanced intelligence agency, and I was kind of proud of the fact that somebody high up in the government was even cared about what we were doing and was interested in looking into it. So
yeah, this is the CIA that today says they weren't interested in UFOs.
Right, exactly. Oh, well, I know, you know, and I have followed since then. But to make a long story short, this resulted in a report about this meeting, which was generated, and later a copy of their report, which was strangely and interestingly garbled in a lot of details, nevertheless, was released. And it turned out, under analysis by people who know more about the workings of the CIA than I do, that apparently they were trying to set me up as a source of some kind. There had been a flurry of very interesting sightings by highly credible, technically trained witnesses all around the Washington area in late in 1964 and early in 1965, and they wanted to see what we had about it and how we got this kind of information. And I think the lesson was that we were outperforming the intelligence agency. We were gathering better information than they were able to do. So that's the background of that.
Richard, Robert has joined us on CFRB 1010. Good evening, Robert.
Good evening.
You have a question?
Yes, I'd like to ask Richard what he thinks about the statements that have been made in some of the UFO literature that some members of the board of NICAP had some relationship to Majestic 12 or CIA, etc., such as Admiral Hillenkoetter.
Okay. That again gets into timing and history. Admiral Hillenkoetter was a Naval Academy classmate of Major Kehoe and graduated in the same class with him and therefore was a friend. And when Major Kehoe was looking for board members, he invited Admiral Hillenkoetter and he accepted. And Admiral Hillenkoetter, who was nominally the first director of the CIA, there was one prior director of the predecessor group called the Central Intelligence Group, but he was the first director of the CIA, and he agreed, he was retired from the agency at that time, and since he took UFOs seriously, agreed to serve on the NICAP board, and he made numerous statements saying, hey, this is serious, we should have hearings, it's a serious matter. Nothing sinister about his involvement.
What year was that, Richard?
1961, too, along in there. There were others, yes, as it turned out, mostly after Major Kehoe and I had left the scene, there were other people that had apparent CIA connections of one level or another who moved in and were involved in one way or another, and I'm not being a conspiracy theorist myself. I don't read too much into this. I don't know what happened at that point. There may have been an effort to Welch NICAP because it was a very effective agency, but I'm not going to read too much into it, as I say. But there were indeed, as a matter of objective fact, at different stages of the history, which needs to be taken into account, there were people with CIA connections involved on the fringes. They did not, nobody in the office, executive staff, had any such connection. And we ran things entirely independently, so, you know, what I want to say is that I have never had any connection, and if somebody could tell me how to access my secret Swiss bank account set up for me by the CIA, please tell me, because I haven't been able to find it yet.
Robert, thank you for your call. We have to move on.
Okay.
Okay, thank you. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Richard, you have been around for a very long time in the ufological field.
Yes, I'm quite ancient.
Yeah. I wasn't meaning to imply that. It was a respectful thing that
okay.
I was saying. You have seen the methods of research and the style of research over a long period of time compared to most of us. What differences do you see between those days, in the early days of ufology, and Donald Kehoe and Alan Hynek, and what's going on today? And how do you feel about it?
Oh, boy. Okay, I can talk for an hour on that, at least.
Okay, we'll turn our microphones off and talk among ourselves.
Okay, well, a lot has changed and a lot has stayed the same. The constant UFO mystery is what keeps me activated. I have a very low patience threshold for quibbling about how many types of aliens there are, where they come from, or why they're here. I think those are essentially unanswerable questions at this point.
Mm-hmm.
The phenomenon is what interests me. I'm interested in those disks and ellipses and cigar-shaped things, and more recently triangular-shaped things, and how they perform and how they hover and zoom straight up out of sight and make right-angle turns and do all sorts of impossible things. This is what intrigues me. That has remained constant over the years.
Have you ever seen any of these things personally yourself, Richard?
Nothing I would claim. I had some very distant light phenomena kinds of things, but I would never report it as a UFO. Mm-hmm. I think too much gets reported. That's very borderline. I think we there's a problem about that. A lot of weak material put out as if it were evidence of something, and I think we need to concentrate on what amounts to the clearly seen in daylight, geometrically shaped objects that do very strange things that outperform anything we know about. That's where we should be concentrating.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, that has remained constant over the years. The big difference, of course, is the abduction phenomenon. And that has developed mostly since about the 1970s. And that has complicated things immensely. It's a very tricky, difficult subject. And I would not care to pronounce on it briefly, except that I take it seriously. I think you can't write it off.
Right.
It is something serious is going on. It has not received the attention it richly deserves. It's wide open. There's no simplistic as the debunkers. I won't call them skeptics. Skeptic is an honorable term that's been very much abused by the psychop people.
Yeah.
They're debunkers. I'm not a debunker. I'm a skeptic. In other words, I want to see facts and evidence. I'm quite willing to listen and find it out. And I think that's what needs to be done with abduction. Something's going on. The social scientists who have, in fact, met and have, in fact, looked into this, say, we have no answer. We cannot explain it in terms of anything we understand. Whereas the physical scientists say, well, it must be psychological. It must be a fad, or it must be something. Was left hanging out there unexplained. So that's the biggest difference in the years I've observed.
Mm-hmm. Richard, Angie's joining us here on CFRB 1010.
Hello. I wanted to know, I went into the Black Vault, and in the Black Vault on the Internet, there's a thing called the Matrix. And I just wanted to know from any of you what you think about it. If it's, I don't know. I don't know what to believe in it because there's so many things going on that aren't true, and I don't know, is it something I should believe in? Is it, where is it coming from?
What's the Matrix, Andy?
The Matrix, it's all kinds of classified documents. It's almost like a novel, and you go, and it's from page zero all the way to page, I think there's 500 pages in it, and I'm on the 35th page, and it talks about abductions, and it talks about mutilations, and how these things started, and how the government's trying to cover it all up.
Okay, I'll have to give you the best answer I can because I'm not familiar with that particular set of material.
Okay.
But I am familiar with Black Vault, and I think he does a very good job of posting up a lot of very interesting documents that are worthy of study.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But if, you know, there's also all kinds of crazy things that get posted on the Internet that...
I rather think, Richard, that he probably wouldn't put up any phony stuff.
That would be my inclination,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, he's got a good reputation,
yes,
for posting good, solid stuff there. So.
Yeah, because I've been interested since I was 10, and I'm really a ufologist. You know, I love it.
Yeah.
And the thing is, I hear so many people making fun of it, and...
You really have to be careful what you get into
indeed
in this field. Thanks for your call, Angie.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Good night.
Bye.
something, of course, that I expect you must have some views on, and that's the efforts being made by various groups to force the United States government to release whatever information it does have on the UFO phenomenon.
Yes.
What are your feelings about these efforts? Say, for instance, the efforts to have it be mandated as a referendum question in various states, for instance?
Okay. Well, of course, NICAP was the pioneering group in calling for congressional hearings, and we actually finally succeeded in 1968, but that was the one and only and last hearings I've ever been in the Congress, and since then I was employed for a considerable period of time by an outfit called Congressional Information Service, which is a private company that publishes government-related information, including some official government relations, although it's not a government agency. And so I know how Congress works, and my basic feeling is that the groups who are trying to put this pressure on tend to be exceedingly naive about how to go about things. There is information in there, but people go around demanding and making insulting comments and, you know, approaching everybody all wrong. You don't approach people in the government. I've lived inside the Washington Beltway for many, many years, and government employees are tend to be very conscientious, honest people, hardworking people, contrary to their possible reputation at more distant points. And it's rather insulting the way they get treated by people who, you're hiding the truth from us, give it to us now or we'll, you know, invade the ramparts or whatever. I think this is exceedingly naive, and I don't think Congress is about to do anything anytime soon unless this whole subject can be put on a more serious scientific level than it has been so far.
Richard, what happened out of the 68 and 1968 congressional hearings, and out of the outcome from that, how would you advise those who are trying to have this occur again, how can they do it differently to have even better results than the last time?
Okay, the one thing that happened out of the 1966 hearings, thanks to a lot of UFO sightings and thanks to work by NICAP and others, was the formation of the University of Colorado UFO study, which initially was promising and then collapsed of its own weight eventually. But it was initially very promising because it was the first time in modern history that a major university under contract to the Air Force Office of Scientific Research was seriously taking a look at the phenomenon and trying to study it quite objectively. And so that was very beneficial. It's a long story, probably too detailed to go into for this broadcast, but there is literature out there that people can read about what happened, and it basically prejudice of scientists, negative prejudice, killed it. So it did not work out in the long run. What they might do differently is, as I say, I think it's very important to stop ranting and raving and cite evidence and facts and serious information. Persuade the people involved why they should take it seriously instead of ranting at them.
We're digesting that one, Richard.
I wonder why everything went silent. I thought, am I off the air?
No.
After having all this time spent researching and looking into all of these matters from many, many different perspectives, what is the most intriguing story that perplexes you still to this day?
One that ranks up there pretty high would be 1965, about the same time that the CIA guy visited me. There was a report from the mountains of Virginia outside of Washington of a technical guy at a technical firm who had encountered an alien. And this was before the days when that was too popular in the UFO field. He was working at a archery range in the middle. It was snowing. He was preparing for an archery meet. And a big craft came down and descended. A smaller craft came out of it. And some beings came out and literally floated toward him and confronted him and then receded and went away. And he was totally shocked and horrified. Again, I report that incident in my book. But But it was one of those cases that impressed me highly because we met with his colleagues, and they were UFO skeptics. And they said, we know this guy. This guy had some kind of thing that scared him. This is legitimate. You know, it was very interesting because it helped my education about should you take this kind of report seriously or not. And after meeting with these technical people, I said, yeah, I guess we have to. He was a draftsman. I believe it was General Electric. It was a major firm like that. I think it was General Electric up in the Valley of Virginia.
And this sighting, this experience, this interaction that he had, this confrontation, as you put it, this was separate from his work duties.
Oh, yes. This was private. It was out. He was working at an archery range. It was a side activity, preparing for a meet and chopping wood and all that. But it was a blizzard going on when this happened, which made it very intriguing, too.
Yes, you don't often hear of sighting reports taking place in the middle of snowstorms, do you?
That case is reported in my book, but also I'm most impressed over the years by people like the airline pilots I've talked to. And
mm-hmm.
they said NICAP, you know, a senior airline captain would walk in to the office, introduce himself, and say, I saw such and such, usually an elliptical or disc-shaped object, and it circled around or paced off my wing, and that's it, and goodbye. I can't talk to anybody about this. I had that happen over and over again. You know, so I've had lots of that. You know, I've had ample to convince me that this is very real and
yeah.
very serious.
Does one of those stories tend to linger in your mind?
Many of them do. One of the special advisors of NICAP was Captain Bill Nash, who had the famous sighting during the 1952 sighting wave, and I knew him and interacted with him a little bit many years after his sighting, but I met so many impressive witnesses over the years, it's hard to single out. The famous 1952 movie film taken by Naval Warrant Officer Delbert Newhouse, which created quite a stir and is reported in Kehoe's book, and mm-hmm. book by Captain Ruppelt and so forth. I met Newhouse, and he would make a great congressional witness should they ever get around to having some hearings, serious hearings. He came by the office unannounced, and I had an opportunity to question him at some length about his sighting, and what intrigued me was something that never made it anywhere else in the literature that I saw. He told me that when he got his film back after the Air Force had analyzed it, that they had cut out the frames showing the disc-shaped objects close up. In other words, you know, they later explained it as seagulls drifting in the air currents over Utah. And the film, he said, showed these clear-cut disc-shaped objects flying by the camera close up, and they cut those frames out. So those frames are somewhere in the secret files.
Joining us on Strange Days Indeed is Jim. Good evening, Jim.
Yeah, hi, guys. Why don't all the UFO organizations get together, take out a commercial on national TV saying, don't report sightings to the government, but to this certain organization? I think you might get a reaction from the government then. Thank you.
Well, first off, that costs an awful lot of money, but there has been some movement get together. We have the UFO Research Coalition now, the Fund for UFO Research, the Center for UFO Studies, and the Mutual UFO Network working together and taking some concerted action.
Mm-hmm.
And we're certainly trying to promote the reporting independently of the government. There is no official government reporting agency.
That's anymore. What I was about to say.
Right.
And
there is no place officially to report it.
Yeah, and there are none here in Canada either. Talking about the advertisement, Joe Firmage certainly had some bucks to throw around as far as advertising was concerned back last winter when he took that full-page ad out in USA Today.
Yes, I think he could be very beneficial to UFO field. In fact, I've done a piece for him which should be posted up on his website fairly soon, which addresses the scientific stereotypes about UFOs. www.theisso.org, and this is the International Space Sciences Organization. I believe I have that right.
That's right, yes.
There's not much there yet, but he's beginning to post up more information about UFOs and my
talking of a forthcoming article, Richard, what else are you up to? Because
I'm glad you asked, because I wanted to mention something very important for those listeners who are aware of the UFO evidence, which was way back in 1964. Of course, it was reprinted by Barnes & Noble a couple of years ago and is available in a very cheap edition for something like $7.98 from Barnes & Noble and easily accessible on the Internet. Volume 2 has been written by me, and it's well over 750 pages. And originally, Barnes & Noble was going to publish it, but they had production problems with it. They're not big on publishing. They're mostly reprint publishers. And we have another publisher looking at it, and I hope it'll get out there, because this represents research on the last 35 years of UFO history. And I found all kinds of interesting things. Very much a straight extension of the original UFO evidence, showing all the same patterns, but a lot of new ones as well. And it gets into great detail on the appearances and shapes and configurations and maneuvers and even clues to the propulsion system. So I think I'm hoping that this will get published very soon.
Well, we'll keep our fingers, eyes, ears, nose, and toes crossed for you. Gene is on the line with us here. Hello, Gene.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. Welcome to CFRB.
Mr. Hall, it's an honor. I have just basically two questions, and if you don't mind, I'll just spit them out, and then you can offer me any information you may have. There's been a lot of talk over the years about the various organizations being set to fight amongst each other, and that it was government-related or whatever, and also that we're being prepared by the government for news, whatever. And then the second thought is Dr. Bruce Goldberg, who I'm sure you've heard of, says that these aliens come from our future. I was just wondering what you thought about all this.
Okay.
There's two issues there, Gene, I gather. First is about how there's some kind of plot underway to go and divide and conquer, have all the various ufological organizations fighting amongst each other.
Theoretically possible, and I wouldn't put it beyond somebody, but I think people tend to give at least the U.S. government far too much credit for being organized. I don't think they're that consistent. I think I'm not even convinced they know a whole lot more than we do. I think they do have information we don't have, and they're confused by it and don't know what to do with it. So, but there could be people out there spreading confusion. That would be sort of standard counterintelligence type or disinformation type things, but I don't concern myself too much about that. On Dr. Bruce Goldberg, yes, I am aware of his writing, and I have no idea how he can conclude what he concludes.
It's rather bizarre.
I don't know how you could possibly know that their beings are from our future. I discussed the issue in my book of time travelers and point out some of the logical paradoxes involved in that issue, and I just don't see how you can know that kind of thing. And I have read his book, and I see great logical leaps, so I'm not terribly impressed by his argument.
Do you think the U.S. government will be making a statement? Apparently some important people in France have come out with a report stating that it's time to study the subject seriously.
Yeah. The Cometa Report.
The Cometa Report, the Fund for UFO Research has a grant and is getting an English language translation of that right now. It's in process, and we hope to get that around so people here can see it. Unfortunately, the news break in France happened on the date that John F. Kennedy Jr. crashed, and nobody heard about it here.
I wonder if there's some link there.
I doubt it. I'm sure that's
your
coincidence.
Thanks for your call, Gene.
Thank you.
We spend a fair amount of time, Richard, on this program because John Velez is a regular on the program. There seems to be a lot of interest and a lot of people who maintain that they have been taken, abducted by strange beings. There are several ufologists out there who figure that we should not be looking at that at all as UFO researchers, but we should stay focused on unidentified flying objects. How do you feel about that?
Well, first I have to say that John Velez is one of my favorite people, and I'm very sympathetic to his cause, and I'm not one of those who says you can afford to ignore this. In fact, in my new book, new volume of UFO evidence, there's extensive coverage of the whole abduction phenomenon and how it evolved out of the background of general UFO sightings. Try to give some insight into that. And I have spent a lot of personal time talking with and interviewing and dealing with, I call them victims because I think they are victims. There are some people who disagree with that. So I'm well aware of the phenomenon. Mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult and messy and hard to investigate, but you can't ignore it for that reason. And yeah. The people are hurting, they're suffering, and you have to take that into account, and I take into account very seriously.
When I think about it, it's an explanation for the phenomena being reported in the skies 24 hours a day now with the Internet. The number of sightings around the planet is staggering.
Yes.
And it's the only explanation that anybody has come up with is these things are relating to certain members of our society in a not very pleasant way.
Yes.
An email here from Michel Deschamps up in Sudbury. Richard, I bought and read your book, Uninvited Guests, and I really enjoyed it. Excellent work. I heard about your new one, and he's looking forward to it being available out there. The new one, of course, being the UFO Evidence Volume 2, a 30-year report. Michel continues, there's a desperate need to present historical UFO events to those who are not aware of this particular part of our history. And experienced researchers like Donald Keough and yourself have done that and are still doing it. Thank you for your dedication to this field. We need more people like you.
Well, that's very nice. I appreciate that.
When did you actually start? When did your interest bring you into working in this field?
I first formally started in 1958. I had been informally involved from about 1954. So it's been close to 50 years. When I was going to university in New Orleans, I published a newsletter on the subject and started getting in touch with other people who were active in the field. And then I went from New Orleans to Washington, D.C. and got involved with NICAP.
Who in the field that you work with, past or present, impressed you the most?
Oh, well, hands down, James McDonald. He was my good friend and idol, my role model.
For our listeners.
Of atmospheric physics at the University of Arizona and set very high standards for the rest of us. Another one I admire very much who's no longer active, but I'm still in touch with him, is Ted Blocher in New York City, who also has very high standards of research. And today there's Bruce McAbee and Dick Haynes and a lot of good people
mm-hmm.
active in the field.
Who don't you like in the field?
Oh, I could talk about that for hours.
but without naming names, but dropping broad enough hints so that most of us recognize who you were talking about.
Names, yeah. I could do it without naming names. I think the people who have obvious axes to grind or out to make a joke or a game out of it or to profiteer on it or hassle other people, you know, these kind of people. And the New Agers, I don't have, I'm well known for this. I got attacked for that recently, as you know, but I do not appreciate what they're doing to the field because they're giving the whole field a bad name. And these are not evil people by any means. I
no.
mean, I know people who hold some so-called, quote-unquote, New Age beliefs, and they can be very nice, sweet people. But I still think they're wrong in their approach to the subject, and when they commandeer it and stuff it in together with all kinds of other weird off-the-wall ideas, it just cheapens the whole field to me. I cannot go along with that. And I know that's controversial, but that's what I believe.
Well, no, it's absolutely legitimate, too. Mind you, maybe these New Agers are in touch with the benevolent beings that they maintain they're in touch with. I mean, who knows? I mean, it could be as real as people like Velez who are taken and have terrible things done to them physically.
Velez is a very, very rational person. I'm very impressed by him. So whenever he posts on there, I usually look at and read.
Yeah. Richard, we're just about at the end of our time together. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that we haven't covered off yet?
Well, I'd like to quickly say that I didn't give the last caller a satisfactory answer to her question about whether I thought the U.S. government was going to make a statement. Short answer is no, I doubt it. Seriously, that anything that comes out there will eventually have to be Waco, Texas situation.
It's exactly what ran through my mind as you said that, yeah.
But no, other than that, I think you've covered the bases pretty well. You know, I just want to say that I'm very active and I'm engaged in a lot of projects, including a study of pre-1947 UFO sightings. So if any of your listeners have them, between the period of 1900 and 1946, I am looking for good sightings from that period, and I would be delighted to have them.
Okay, and if you have any of those sightings between 1900 and 1946, then please get in touch with us, and we'll pass those on to Richard. Thank you very much for spending this time with us tonight, Richard. We'd love to have you back again and spend some more time together, because we didn't even scratch the surface of the good stuff. You know.
Right. Okay, I'll be glad to do more in the future.
That's great, Richard. Thank you again for joining us.
Okay.
Good night, and thank you, Richard Hall. Go out and buy Richard's book, Uninvited Guests, a documented history of UFO sightings, alien encounters, and cover-ups.
Time, Richard Hall joined us on the broadcast version of Strange Days Indeed in September 1999. Filmmaker David Cherniak has been on this program many times in recent years, talking about, among other things, the lead-up to and the broadcast of his outstanding documentary, UFOs, The Secret History. Last week, I received a copy of the three-disc set of UFOs, The Secret History, and frankly, I'm dazzled. So, let's talk why with David Cherniak. Hello, David.
Hello, oh, so nice to see you dazzled.
I light up like a...
like a Christmas tree.
Or Hanukkah candles or something.
Or a UFO.
Or a UFO. Boy, you spent 3 years putting the original doc together for the History Channel here in Canada.
Three of the happiest years of my life, I might add.
Really? Better than Prague and film school?
Oh, no, that was easy. just, you know, Russian tanks to worry about, you know, that wasn't too difficult.
I think I missed the sarcasm in three of the happiest years of my life.
The shoot had its ups and downs, but overall it was a real blast. To carry your hotel on your back with you in the form of a 30-foot RV for 4 months and 18,000 miles around North America. It was a lot of fun. I mean, it was, you know, in retrospect, the only way I could have done it. I would have gone nuts checking into, you know, different Motel 6s every night.
And then, of course, it was your studio, too, because most of the interviews that you shot were in that RV, weren't they?
Not most, but probably a good 10 of them. I think I shot all in all around 60 interviews. I think a good 10 of them were done in the RV. It was just convenient, or the UFO researcher I was talking to, and this is nobody in particular, wasn't thrilled about taking me into either their messy house or their realm of paranoia that I might be dragging along some spy with them. So it became a very tight studio, but a workable studio nonetheless. They were all done green screen, and it was the curtain rod that separated the driver's cab from the living room became the hanger for the green screen.
And when you actually shot in people's places, was that green screen as well?
Most of the time. There were a few exceptions, mostly for reasons of space. I couldn't fit a green screen in, but when there was space, I would do it. It just allowed me a little bit more control over the final imaging process. Because when you're mostly a one-man band, and I mostly was, lighting becomes a fairly, not difficult thing to do, but time-consuming thing when you're setting up the camera, setting up lights, and chatting with the person who you're interviewing. It becomes this kind of frazzling experience, or can be. And when you have to control the amount of light in the background because you want to balance very carefully the light on the subject with the light on the background, becomes even more difficult. So by doing it with green screen and shooting plates, if I was interviewing the person in their native environment, the background would be someplace from their house. Often the same room. But I would just shoot it either as a still or a freeze frame in the video camera. And that way I could control the intensity of it. Getting a little bit of atmosphere becomes quite critical.
And made several people look as if they lived in palaces.
Well, to be honest, my wife proudly points to all of our artwork in a lot of the interviews, or living room walls, yes. Well, or sometimes they were palaces, you know. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, in some places, for whatever reason, a plate I would have shot in one person's house, I had to use with a person who would have been thousands of miles away because it fit with color and texture and things like that. I won't go into specifics whose house was behind which researcher, but once in a while separated by a few sounds.
And if you look at the extras discs that you have in the three-disc set, mm-hmm. Yeah, you can figure out who you actually didn't shoot.
Yes,
in
not in black limbo.
It does look like a million-dollar production, though. I mean, you put an astounding amount of expertise and technical craft into the documentary.
Thank you. Yes, that's one of the reasons why it took 3 years to do. It was about 15 months in post. And I mean, it was always planned that we do a lot of effects work, so I just knew that that would be there, and, you know, judging how long that stuff is going to take is always extremely difficult. I think it took probably twice as long as I originally figured, but I think the end result was worth it. And certainly there was no time pressure from History Television to get it done by a certain date. They were very understanding and very encouraging, and never for a moment suggested that it was a problem for them to go through the delay, through the 6 to 8 month delay.
And, of course, that project happened before the major financial meltdown that we've had of late. So there was, I guess, a reasonable amount of money in the budget. The doc ran here in Canada on the History Channel.
History Television.
Has anybody else picked the doc up?
In terms of broadcasters, not yet. There is a distributor out of New York, a fairly large company, that's been trying to shop it around. But the timing is very bad because of the economic meltdown. So we'll see what happens. That's one reason. I think the other might be that, you know, when times get tough, broadcasters try to widen their audience as much as they can to increase their advertising dollar. And for broadcasters, that to a certain extent, shall we say, means dumbing things down. And if the documentary is addressing too high a level of education, i.e. grade 10 and up as opposed to grade 6 and up, it may not do as well in difficult times. I think that's one of the other issues that's going on.
Is it possible that something else that is scaring them is the fact that it's very close to the truth, if not the truth?
That's hard to say. I mean, certainly that may be a part of it. You can see what the higher up broadcasters in the food chain tend to do. Networks like Discovery would never, I expect, in the present environment or historically in the recent past, air a documentary that is as open to the question of extraterrestrial visitation or earthbound visitation as this one is open to it. It's easier for them to defend against any kind of criticism. Although the other thing is, I haven't received any negative feedback from any so-called debunkers at all. whether that's because they didn't see it or because they really didn't have anything to terribly criticize the film about, I have no idea. But I certainly, as you well know, did not leave prototypical historical debunkers alone. I gave them what I feel is their just due.
A mildly savage mauling.
No, I wouldn't describe it as... I would describe it as a mildly satirical mauling for making claims that are patently ridiculous about explanations for various incidents.
You've now come to the point where you feel that it's a good time, and as I mentioned, there's now a three-disc set, which people can order from allinonefilms.com. You've not only put out the doc in the box set, but you've also put two additional discs in the box set, which particularly the abductions disc is way longer than the actual doc itself, and features some well-respected abduction researchers such as Bud Hopkins, Dave Jacobs, and pieces on John Mack. That's wonderful because that disc gives a really thorough history of abductions.
And all the possible interpretations that are presently floating around, from the hardcore reality interpretation of the Hopkins-Jacobs scenario to various psychological explanations given by two, I think, very sympathetic psychologists to the abduction phenomenon, and also going a little bit into alternative reality explanations, although when we get into that realm, we border on the occult, and I think that's an interesting area to explore, but possibly an entire different documentary. And I think the abductions addendum runs about 2 hours and 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So you're quite right, it is longer than the original documentary. But there's a lot to say about abduction.
Yes.
And part of the problem, I think, is that the subject tends to be trivialized. In the documentary, I deal with it historically by touching upon the significant historical moments, what they meant, and how they affected the general history of the phenomenon, both from a sociological point of view and in terms of the research and the potential meaning. That's still comparatively brief because it doesn't begin to address what abductions might be. So the addendum really takes a look in a fairly, I think, balanced way at what abductions might be. The other disc is shorter. I think it's 50 minutes, and it's comprised of two subjects. One takes a look at the extraterrestrial hypothesis, both historically in the development of the UFO phenomenon and what it means. But the other one is called Contact and includes a lot of speculation about how an advanced race, a really advanced race, would go about making contact with, if that's even the right word, because I don't even believe that that's the right word. That's the word we use. But when we're talking about civilizations that could be billions of years older than us, contact, I don't think there would be that much point of contact. Yet they have to somehow take into account emerging civilizations. So there's something, I figure, there's probably some kind of protocol that exists for engaging, accommodating, assimilating, absorbing
mm-hmm.
an emerging civilization at certain point. But there's a lot of talk around various timetables and possibilities and the effects of contact. And I'm happy to say that it's never dismissed in those conversations in simple terms, because I think any kind of contact with an advanced civilization is going to have profound effects on us. Even just the unambiguous knowledge that we are being visited, that's accepted and announced by our official organs of authority, is going to have a huge impact on our culture that I don't think we can even begin to imagine, to tell you the truth. I think very little thinking has gone into it. And what thinking has gone into it tends to be superficial in terms of, oh, we can handle it, we're big boys, it's not that difficult, look, I can think about it, I accept the fact that they're visiting us and it doesn't affect me at all. Well, maybe not you, but you're not everybody. I'm not talking about you, Errol, I'm talking about the general population out there, which runs with a lot of things, belief-wise. We live according to myths, and anything that's going to profoundly and deeply alter the myths we live by, as something like this would, is going to have a huge impact.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I should say is that these discs, these addenda discs, were done up from the interviews I did with everybody, which in the documentary tend to be used, but used in very short clips. So I have this massive resource, and it was possible to dig into it on those three themes, abductions, contact, and the extraterrestrial hypothesis. There's other things I could do. It's just nobody is really paying me to do them, and I have to make a living. So if I do get around to doing them, it'll either be because there's a demand or because I have some spare time and the inclination to do them. But there are other things that I do have planned.
Other things that you do have planned as far as addenda?
Yeah, well, it could be done.
Well, we'll see what the reaction is to this three-disc set.
I hope very good.
I hope so, too.
But we'll see.
And I trust that the financial situation for a lot of people today will ease, or their interest will be piqued such that they go to All-in-One Films and order a copy of UFOs, The Secret History.
That would be very nice. I would appreciate it greatly.
And possibly other documentaries that you've made, because your site has a huge number of docs, whether people can order them from you or go to CBC and pick up the original works that you did on abduction.
Well, they can. They can also, some of my favorite ones that I've done for CBC are available on my site free of charge. It's streaming. Anyone's computer can stream video these days. You can go to allinonefilms.com and they can just order, and it'll require them to register. It's just one way of keeping my bandwidth usage on my server within reason. So all they have to do is register. And then they can view about a half a dozen of my favorite CBC films for free. Right then and there. They're older films, but one of them may be of interest because it's the very first film that was ever done on abductions. I did it with Bud Hopkins back, I think, in 1987, when the whole abduction thing was just beginning to become noticed. When we shot the film, I don't think Bud's book had even been published yet. I think Whitley's book was just coming online, and it's a very interesting film in terms of a historical moment. It's called the E.T. Hypothesis. There's also a very nice documentary I did with Stephen Hawking in the mid-80s, one of my favorite films. So there's a few things there.
And if I recall correctly, there was some discussion about string theory there, too, wasn't there?
Yes, there was.
Why don't you tell us the story about Stephen Hawking and string theory?
Well, I shot my film with Stephen. This is from Whisper CBC. This is before he became a computer voice. He still could make sounds that could be interpreted by those closest to him. I couldn't understand them for the most part. And we shot the film when Stephen was holding a quantum gravity conference in Cambridge. And a lot of leading lights in the world of theoretical physics attended. And during the shooting, I mentioned to Stephen that it would be really nice to film him and a couple of physicists sitting around and just shooting the shit the way physicists would shoot the shit on their subject matter. So he suggested that I go and invite two people to come into his office. And I went out and got them, and they turned out to be two of the leading lights of string theory. One of them had invented it, the other was the golden-haired theoretician boy. And then they came into the office, and we started to film, and Stephen proceeded to launch into an attack on string theory. Caught them by surprise. They defended themselves, I thought, quite adequately, but afterwards they kind of came up to me fairly sheepishly and were quite concerned that I would project their academic reputation when I edited that section. The other funny thing that happened during the shooting of that was I had arranged to meet Stephen to shoot with him going through the backs of King's College, Cambridge, which are exquisitely beautiful. It's kind of a green area with all these ancient buildings on a quadrangle around. And we got to the place where we were supposed to meet, and it was a gate, and it was locked. And Stephen came rolling up in his wheelchair by himself, and we said to him, "Stephen, the gate appears to be locked." And he proceeded to say something like, "Wrong, nerd, you know, wrong." And we said, "What? What?" And it became excruciatingly embarrassing because I had to keep asking him to repeat it, and I could never quite make out what he was saying. And this went on for about 5 minutes, and I was feeling utterly, utterly awful. And then somebody walked up who obviously knew Stephen, leaned down beside him, and Stephen said, "Walk, walk." And the person turned to us and said, "The key is in his pocket," and walked off.
Oh, and of course, Hawking has now resigned his chair.
Yeah, I think it's kind of not compulsory, but it's what you do when you reach a certain age. He has the Isaac Newton chair in theoretical physics and mathematics at Cambridge, so it's what you do.
Let me add, for those who were puzzled by the string theory reference, that if you really want to know, go to Michio Kaku's website.
Yes, he's one of the principal proponents of string theory.
MichioKaku.com.
And for those of you who want to know what it is, it's essentially a theoretical way of trying to describe what's going on in the deepest level of physical reality, not as particles or waves, but as seeing particles as vibrating strings. There are questions about it, and it's certainly not generally accepted. I wouldn't even say that it's a mainstream theory in theoretical physics these days. As a matter of fact, there are many theoretical physicists who feel that it's a gigantic waste of time because it doesn't seem to be verifiable. Seems to be a nice piece of mathematics, but doesn't seem to be experimentally verifiable, at least up to the present time. I mean, some string theorists who may be listening in may have other ideas and they can correct me, but that's my understanding of it.
Oh, you'll get bunches of hate mail now.
Well, I'm sure, you know, they're vicious people, these theoretical physicists. Vicious, vicious, I tell you.
Nasty ankle biters. UFOs, The Secret History, the DVD set, includes abductions, contact, and the extraterrestrial hypothesis. There's a link on the program's page where you clicked to listen to this. Go to All in One Films and, if you like, order yourself a copy of the 3-disc set and also watch the abductions documentary for free online that David did for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation.
It's called The ET Hypothesis.
Centuries ago.
Centuries ago. More centuries than I do care to remember.
David, thank you for this. I trust that broadcast sales pick up as well as the economy.
I would hope so.
And I trust that thousands of people buy this. This is a 3-disc set that really needs to be in every library in the English-speaking world.
Which is true. This is very true. If anybody knows any librarian purchasers, they should go to their public library and demand that they buy the DVD set, because it really should be in a library. It's probably the only film that has ever taken a look at the UFO subject from the point of view of cultural history, which, as I point out on my website blurb, really needs to be done in order to understand the history of the phenomenon.
And for every person on this planet's sake.
I tend to agree. Otherwise, I wouldn't have spent 3 years making the film.
David, look forward to talking to you the next time and hearing wonderful news about both the broadcast and the disc sales.
Thank you, Errol.
Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. April 7th this year, 2009, Grant Cameron interviewed the two daughters of the late Reverend Turner Holt. Here they tell the story of bodies their father said he saw under the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. And these bodies may well predate Roswell, as the first daughter was told the story in 1948.
I'm Aline Holt Gramley, and my father was the Reverend Turner Holt. And he came to visit me one day in around about 1948. I know that because that was when my oldest daughter was a toddler. And we were watching her play and we were talking. And he said, you know, there's something I want to tell you. He said, I think that someone in my family should know about this besides me. And I was sworn to secrecy by my cousin Cordell Hull, who was Secretary of State under Roosevelt. And he said, I just feel that I should tell you so that someone in the family would know. And so he told me about going to Washington for a conference, I think it was called, and of ministers of all denominations from all over the country. And he was a representative from this area. And why he was chosen is probably because Cordell Hull put his name in the box, because wouldn't be very likely that anyone in Washington would have picked a preacher from a little town like Shenandoah. And so while he was there, I'm not sure how they got together, but he and his cousin Cordell Hull, I think it was third or fourth cousin, something like that.
Yeah, but it's related.
Yeah.
Through the Riley family.
Yeah. And he got together with him at the State Capitol building. That's where Cordell wanted him to be. I don't know if they went to lunch first or if they just met there. And Cordell said that he wanted to show him something. And he said, but you have to swear that you'll never, ever tell anybody. And so they did. And so they started down, down, down in the building. And finally, my dad said, where are we going anyway? And Cordell said, well, you'll see. And they went down through the regular basement into a sub-basement. And
so it was in the Capitol building.
In the Capitol building. And so anyway, when they got down there, well, there was kind of a long hallway they went through that was lighted, but nothing off to the side in any rooms were lighted. And so when they got to where they were going, Cordell opened the door and he reached in and switched on the light. And he said, now this is something really strange that is down here. And there were, I don't recall whether it was three or four, but there was these large jugs, that glass jugs that were on some kind of a stand that had these little people in them. And he said, well, they were like people, but they weren't. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, they had all the same things that we have, but he said, well, instead it seemed to me like their heads were a little too large for their body and their eyes were shut, but I think their eyes were bigger than ours. And I said, well, how tall were they? And he said, oh, I don't really know. And I said, well, 6 feet? Oh, no. So we kind of went back and forth on how tall they were, and finally settled on about 4 foot tall. And so then Cordell Hall called his attention to some kind of a machine that he said was a flying machine of some sort. And Dad said, well, it doesn't have wings. And this was, of course, about right around 1935. And
excuse me, wasn't it wrecked? Wasn't the machine?
Yeah, it was in pieces.
A wreck.
And Dad said that there was really, really pretty shiny, like silver, but he said it wasn't anything that he'd ever seen before. So he couldn't say what kind of material it was. And so Cardell said, yeah, but just lift this. And Dad said, that looks heavy. And so Carter went with his fingers on the edge of it, and it was very lightweight. And so they talked about that a little bit. And then as far as I know, Cardell didn't explain anything to him. He just wanted him to see it. And then they left. And that was what Dad told me. And I don't recall that he said ever said anything again about it. And I didn't ask him anything. Looking back on it, I don't know why, but I didn't.
And when did you hear the story?
It was around 1948,
yeah.
Because that was when Eloise was
Lucille, when did you first hear when did you hear the story? Did he tell you about the same time?
I don't even remember.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't remember when it was. I was young.
Uh-huh.
And she's told it just the way it is.
And he approached you with the same thing, that this is a story that somebody should know?
He thought somebody eventually should know about this, about the creatures he saw. Now, I remember his saying three glass jars. He referred to them as creatures in them. He didn't say people or animals. He said creatures that he had never seen before.
And he only told you the story one time?
Oh, yes, only once. Yeah. And, because I think he sort of had a guilty conscience that he had promised not to tell, but as time went on, he realized that somebody should know about this. You know. And at the time, there was a sub-basement in the Capitol building. We have found out since.
Yeah.
And now it's something else. Railroads down there or something else.
I think it's a bomb shelter or something for the people in the Senate and Congress.
Okay. And he did definitely mention the year 1935. Was he sure of the year? Or is...
No, he didn't mention the year, but it was when Cordell was Secretary of State under Roosevelt, and the letters I have are dated 1935, and that was when he was in Washington.
Okay.
So that's the only way we know. At the time, neither one of us realized that there was anything that...
We didn't know it was going to be important.
That's right. No reason to remember. You know.
Yes. Okay, and the last question... can you describe why you wrote the letter? How that came about?
Myself. I felt somebody should know about this. As I grew older and maybe hopefully got a little more sense in my head, I thought this is something that is very important. And hearing about the Roswell thing and other things, I thought this galaxy we live in, the Milky Way, is huge, and there has to be a lot of life in it. This was my thought, and I thought for that reason someone should know about this. This is a big galaxy, and there are many other galaxies. However, getting from one galaxy to another certainly seems impossible, but from one solar system in this galaxy, it could be possible with advanced civilizations much more advanced than ours, because we're way out at the edge, and some of those that are more interior might be much more advanced. That was my thought.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I must tell somebody this.
And so you wrote to...
I forget who I wrote to.
Jones.
was it the Center for UFO Studies in Chicago? Hynek, yeah.
I got information on who the person would be from my son, who is a scientist.
Okay.
And a Harvard graduate and a scientist. And he didn't want us to tell it because he thought we could get into a really jumbled mess. But we were telling the truth.
Yeah.
And the truth always, it doesn't get you in trouble unless you committed a crime, you know.
Okay.
And so anyhow, I just felt this must be told, as because the Roswell thing made me think something is going on. And I think the reason Dad was appointed to this committee in Washington on called World Order, and the thing was that they were afraid that we would be invaded by a lot of these so-called creatures, and that goodness only knows what would happen. And Dad's job around in this area was to calm people down and help people cope and find other people who could help, other ministers and whoever could help cope with an invasion from outer space or from one of these other solar systems. And that was why I wrote the letter. I thought, this really needs to be told. Something has happened.
And what has been the reaction since you... This is many years ago you wrote the letter, correct?
I can't remember.
Yes. What kind of reaction have you gotten in terms of...
Well, very guarded reaction from people, which is understandable. Most people don't believe it.
Yeah.
You know. And that's understandable, too. But if you're a scientist or a scientific-minded, you realize that there has to be a lot of life out there of one kind or another. And a lot of it could be a lot smarter than we are. Most of it probably is, you know. And that's my thought. This ought to be general knowledge, because we might have to, who knows, we might have to defend ourselves. But the great, huge distances make it unlikely.
Yeah.
I don't think we have anything to worry about because of distances. And certainly, I think we have nothing to worry about from other galaxies, but perhaps from ours.
From our own.
But my knowledge is so limited that just knowing about the Roswell thing and then about what my father saw. And he was a very honest man, had all his faculties. He was also a very intelligent man. Very, very intelligent.
And when did your father pass away?
It's been in 66.
Yeah, I was going to say in the 60s, but I don't remember the year.
In 66, in February of 66. And it's been a long time now.
Yeah.
He wasn't very old. He got leukemia.
Okay.
And acute leukemia.
Crop circles in Germany, an abduction in Korea, and a strange light over Go Home Lake here in Ontario. Bobby Rowley.
Last Saturday night, July 6th, a husband and wife experienced an intriguing phenomenon up at their cottage on Go Home Lake in Muskoka Cottage Country, north of Toronto. After dinner, at about 9:30 p.m., they decided to take a cruise in their boat. It was a beautiful evening, just about dusk. They turned their running lights on, cast off, and headed, very slowly, in a northerly direction. It was a quiet, calm night. About 10 minutes into their cruise, the husband noticed a very bright white light to the west and off the port side of the boat, at about 35 degrees off the horizon. He asked his wife if she thought it was a star, but then he noticed it was moving, and in the same direction as they were, at about the same speed, over some treetops along the shoreline. Reports the husband, a self-proclaimed skeptic, as an experiment, he increased speed to about 30 miles per hour, and sure enough, the object did the same thing, just enough to stay with them. They were both amazed that it reacted. Was it a fluke? So they slowed down again to almost a stop, and it did the same. They sped up and turned 180 degrees and watched it turn the same way in their direction, in a bank turn as opposed to an instant change of direction on a level plane. They came to a stop and turned the lights out. The object sat, hovering in one spot. They couldn't leave the lights off for long because another boat was coming, and it passed them going south, about 200 feet off their starboard side. They thought the lighted observer might then pick up the other boat, but it continued to hover. The wife felt a little spooked, so they decided to head back to the cottage. The lighted object stayed with them during the five-minute trip back to their cottage. They tied up the boat and watched the object drift slowly out of sight over the trees that surround the lake. They're back up at Go Home Lake, as you hear this report, to see if they can spot it again, this time with a digital video camera in hand. Thanks to Sue Derrick and Lisa Greed from Para Researchers of Ontario for that report.
Interesting place to have a sighting, huh?
One of
your favorite places. It just happens to be where you vacation, you and your family, every year, Go Home Lake. Does going up there this summer have more appeal now?
Oh, I think so. I may be observing a little more from that deck.
Thanks, Bobby.
Well, we've had several things that have been somewhat difficult to deal with in the past while since we last talked with Alfred Lemberg down there in Enterprise, Alabama, some of which you have heard earlier in this program. And Alfred always contributes observations to what has preceded him in this program. So, hello, Alfred. It's been a while.
Yes, it has. And we have had some unfortunate things happen in ufology here in the last month or so. Mac Tonies, Lonnie Zamora, Richard Hall, all of these people will be more than missed.
I thought that what Furry had to say about Richard Hall and Richard Hall's work was pretty damn good.
It really was. And I'll get into that in just a second. But with regard to Lonnie Zamora, I think it's significant to point out that he was, all of his days, a proud, sober man, now has an eternal fame that he didn't have to lift a finger for himself. He was not one to grandstand. He was not one to make himself overmuch. He was not one to talk about this Socorro incident that he was involved with.
A fine, upstanding citizen of Socorro, and not only a citizen, but a well-respected policeman down there.
Well-respected policeman, husband, father, grandfather. The guy just rang every bell, touched every bass. He's just absolutely wonderful.
And there's been a lot of idiocy lately about explanations, once again, and fatuous, stupid, dumbass explanations for what it was that Lonnie Zamora saw out there in the desert outside Socorro, New Mexico.
Well, you will certainly get no argument from me in that score. No, there's some of the stuff that's going on and resurrecting the old histories and trying to paint new pictures on old facades, it's just really revolting and obnoxious. And I think we know who these people are, and I think they will come to their just desserts.
We trust.
Yes. Mac Tonies is another one. Lost him pretty much in the prime of his life there, a real tragedy, and, well, looks to me like proof positive that it may be that only the good do die young. Mac Tonies was the author of After the Martian Apocalypse, a very well-received book about anomalies on the surface of Mars. He was also an author of a book of science fiction called Illuminated Black, which I have not seen myself, but I'm looking forward to seeing that. He just finished a book kind of moving away from the extraterrestrial hypothesis and was moving on into more Earth-centered and perhaps human-centered mass consciousness things. I think I'm looking forward to reading it. About Mac Tonies, though, he was a hugely intelligent young man. He was not remotely pretentious. He was very sincerely unusual. He was a very principled gentleman, supremely articulate, but approachable, and a blooming talent that had pretty much bloomed, and I think we could hope for more blooms later on. And man, what a great voice for radio. Just unbelievable. Really a tragedy that he had to die so young.
For those of you who haven't heard the interview that I did with Mac Tonies, it's right there in the archive, probably about a half a dozen programs down from this one.
Yeah, as I recall, he had some very interesting things to say there, too, that will live long, long after him, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with regard to Richard Hall, Dave Frelott, in his piece, put it together for us and put it in a nice little bag. I'm going to quote something that Dave Frelott had said about Richard Hall. Richard Hall has left us a legacy of meticulous, level-headed, intense investigation into UFOs and everything associated with them. He went on to go into some pretty good detail about his very careful documentation of ufology since the 1950s, that he was factually exact and painstakingly thorough in everything he did in that regard. He was unstintingly professional, where he made virtually no money at all and still maintained that professionalism. Really, a man to be commended in all venues and all areas. Dave Frelott went on to say that the only way to dishonor the legacy that Richard Hall left was not to follow it up. I have to agree with him 100%, but I'm going to try to go one further than Dave Frelott did. Dave indicated that it was time for ufologists to step up and complete what Hall had laid the groundwork for. And I couldn't agree more, but in an effort to flesh that out a little bit, I want to talk about how Richard Hall was just one man of significant others who have provided enough quality scholarship, enough incisive research, and enough enduring attention to detail to give mainstream science every reason, every encouragement, and every opportunity, Errol, that it needs to face this UFO thing like brave men and women and not the cowards they've aped thus far. And I hope I don't put too fine a point on it there. See, mainstream, or maybe I should say corporate mainstream science, has to know about the actuality of UFOs. How could they not, given Richard Hall and Jacques Vallée and Doctors Haynes and McDonald and Sturrock and Hynek, and this is forgetting entirely gentlemen like Stanton Friedman, Richard Dolan, Frank Fascino, and Robert Hastings. All of these T's and all of these I's are dotted by these gentlemen and more. Now, Richard Hall, and I think Richard Hall was the same kind of man as his admitted hero, James McDonald, was. See, like McDonald, Hall didn't see the cowards of mainstream science. He believed in the system, okay? He didn't see the cowards, or he preferred not to. He always seemed to presume that science felt that UFOs were not justified because of a dearth of evidence supporting it, and that it was put off by the kooks sucked in by the vacuum left by a neglecting science in the first place. I think Richard Hall confused an idealistic science with the corrupt corporate persons pretending they were practicing it. Richard Hall believed in science's ideal. And finally, with regard to that ideal, that ideality, an ideal is only ever existing as an intellectual exercise. And science, an intellectual exercise, is only ever an ideal. It remains that persons fall short of an ideal. And that's our science. Science falls short of itself. Now, science is one of those better means to an end. I mean, we all have to admit, when you think of the toys that it produces, the advancements that it's made, the improvements in quality of life and elevations of all types. But Errol, it is not all means to all ends, and it is not the end. We are more than number and measure. We are more than predictability and repeatability. We are more than our reductionisms and our infant Cartesianism. And as useful as these things are, science fails with regard to UFOs. And with regard to that failure, and it is a failure, it's also a failure failing Richard Hall. So we might be wrong to point at our fractionated ufologists and an overbusy kookdom. We'd have to point directly at an indolent mainstream science abdicating their responsibility, and mainstream science has to know.
Science is not practicing science. It is practicing ass protection as far as tenure and payroll and good standing with scientific associations.
You're absolutely right, Errol. And they're always quick to point out that they're so ready to be proved wrong in their own theories, talking about the scientists. And when it's all said and done, these individuals are just not practicing what they preach. They are worried about redoing their work. They're overproud of the work that they've accomplished. They don't want to look at new things. They don't want to investigate this thing the way it needs to be investigated. And that's the failure to Richard Hall. And I think a failure that we can lay almost completely at the feet of science. And, you know, with regard to this subject of dying before you discover the answer, I'm reminded of Philip Klass caterwauling on his deathbed about how we would all of us die without getting one step closer to the answer. And it was kind of like a curse that he laid at our doorstep there as he was shuffling off the mortal coil himself. I will always be a little angry with him for doing that, not that it wasn't expected. But I got to tell you, the answer, as conjectured, nobody's going to get to it, Errol. We're not capable of getting to it. It is beyond the intelligence of our very facile humanity. But I got to tell you also that this in no way precludes the use of that path going in the direction of that answer. And for myself, I'm content to tread that path, as I may never get to the destination, because, see, there are answers and better questions on the way, Errol. There are others met on that path. There's the presumption that there is something found at the end of that path, or I suspect there wouldn't be a path at all. And moreover, there is the ball lateraled over to fellow travelers on that path, like the one that we very gratefully received from Richard Hall at his passing. Those balls lateral to us as fellow travelers on that path, like Richard Hall, is carried forward out of respect. It's all we can do.
And as I was saying to Dave Ferlot earlier, Dick Hall now knows what all of this is about, because that's the way I happen to bend. In that once we shuck off this mortal coil, then we get to know everything about everything. And in the same way, Philip Klass now knows how wrong he was.
That's the way I roll myself. On a kind of happier note with regard to Hall, it seems that he was finally there at the last part of his life, was on the trail of a final mystery that is also highly strange with regard to that book that he was trying to write, Running Code, The Night the Alien Died. Do you have any information on if or when that thing might be released?
I have no idea. And as Dave and I were talking earlier, Dick was looking for funding to go check out the witnesses to that before they died, and unfortunately he wasn't able to raise that funding. So whether in fact there is a book that's waiting to be published or not, who knows?
I'll tell you, the abduction phenomena is a squirrely bag to approach by any means. It's full of all sorts of crazy things that would tend to degrade its potential for reality. But if somebody of Richard Hall's intelligence and capability could be interested in the abduction phenomenon, then I'm here to tell you it has got to be a real thing worthy of some kind of investigation.
And I'm quite looking forward to John Velez getting all of Richard Hall's files on abduction.
One thing on the program that I found very interesting to listen to, and I found some interesting video on YouTube that I had sent you a link for, and maybe you can put that up for the SDI people so that they can look at it, too.
It's there already.
Oh, super. Talking about the two sisters and the creatures in the bottle. Cordell Hull, Secretary of State under Roosevelt back in the 30s, 1935 specifically, apparently, well, a very strange situation where he called in an old friend of his to just go down there and have a look at something under the Capitol building in 1948, talking about alien beings in bottles of formaldehyde. Just completely blows you away and must be completely uncredible. I didn't mean incredible, I meant uncredible, because, well, it's uncredible until you listen to the two elderly ladies that are talking about their father and that whole affair. I was just really impressed with the fact that why did he divulge all this information so late in his life to his daughters? Because somebody should know about this stuff. Well, I just thought these ladies were just completely credible and were telling a truth as they knew it. They were very convincing, very sincere, very sober. They were almost apologetic, being concerned about an invasion and steadfastly doing what they took to be the responsible thing to do. I was just wholly impressed with these ladies.
Me too. And thanks to Grant Cameron for finding those two ladies, recording them. A gem of a find.
Oh, yeah, it was. And, you know, something else, too, when you look at this YouTube video where these two elderly ladies are being interviewed, I think, by their daughter, I looked for some kind of divergence in the stories that they were telling, and no, it matched up with regard to what Grant Cameron recorded and what the daughter recorded on video.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, and 17 years before Roswell.
Yeah, exactly. The only other thing I'd like to mention this trip, Errol, is David Cherniak and his documentary.
From an historic point of view, an overview of the history of ufology from the Kenneth Arnold days right up through to the now, it's absolutely amazing. Cherniak has captured the essence of all of the things that have been going on, ufologically speaking.
Finally got the disc with the documentary proper on it all by itself. What was some of the stuff on the other discs?
What he did was he went back to all the recordings that he'd made during the course of putting this documentary together and then pulled out what he thought would be historically interesting to add into the box set. What particularly intrigued me was the abductions disc. And then there's the ET Hypothesis disc.
Well, I'm really looking forward to seeing that myself. With regard to the extraterrestrial hypothesis, going back to Dick Hall here for just a second, I'm amused to see that how the extraterrestrial hypothesis is so far up your nose that you can feel knees scrubbing your top lip. And the reason I bring that up is that running code, "The Night the Alien Died." Well, you know, you can't get much more explicative of an extraterrestrial hypothesis than that.
An intriguing story that, and we'll see if anybody follows up on it, although I'm not holding my breath.
Well, maybe that'll be some of the information that can winnow its way on over to John Velez eventually.
Or possibly to a researcher investigator down there very close to where all of that went down. Would be really useful to find somebody there.
You know, with regard to John Velez, he's coming back to the fold, isn't he? Is he going to get back on board?
He's now got his own domain name, abductioninformationcenter.com. So he is in the midst now of updating the website. So whether he's actually coming back into the fold on a full-time basis as far as this program is concerned or the UFO updates list is still up in the air, he tends to pop up, fire off a couple of shots, and duck back down again.
Yeah, watched him do that myself. Well, the last thing I would like to make mention of is that I was very pleased to hear Bobby's piece talking about Go Home Lake.
Yeah, which is where the family cottage is, and we spent many, many happy hours late at night out in the puddle boat, laying on our backs in the middle of the bay. The family cottage is in Hart Bay, and we would pedal out into the middle of Hart Bay and lay on our backs, late at night, looking up at the stars and the sky and the satellites and the meteors and whatever was going on.
It was just such a joy and a pleasure to hear her, though. She sounded so calm and competent and unforced and sounding like a real ufological pro, especially given that she wasn't that into it, was she?
No, not really. She and her family had always been fans of CFRB, and Bobby and her Sibs all grew up with mother and dad listening to CFRB. So when I came along and was doing Strange Days Indeed, although Bobby and I go back many, many years, she would drive me into the station just to be there and soak up some of the old atmosphere that she and her family had only felt over the radio. And then I said to her, hey, you know what? You should be on this program. And so for a while she was. And it happened that during the course of the while that she was on the radio with me, this story popped up about Go Home Lake and Heart Bay.
I just wish I could have gotten to know her better myself, but we never even got to speak, even on the phone.
Bobby was an amazing teacher, was well-loved by everyone. I don't think there was anybody who didn't like Bobby Rowley. She was quite an amazing woman and taken far too soon. Amazing, amazing woman, and sure gonna miss her. So, have we covered everything that you'd like to get into this time?
I think I've just about squeezed the lemon dry.
Yeah, funnily enough, that was exactly the term that I was going to use. Alfred, thank you.
Hey, thank you, Errol.
And we'll talk to you next time.
My best to you, buddy.
Good observation, sir. Bye. That's this edition of Strange Days Indeed. My thanks to Dave Ferlott, David Cherniak, and Alfred Lemberg. Until next time.
Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mascardelli. Send any questions or comments to SDI@virtuallystrange.net. Strange Days Indeed is the copyright of Random Fit Productions. Join us again for more Strange Days Indeed from the Virtually Strange Network.